are going to get back to some pediatric critical care medicine.
It's really hard for a young infant to go from 140 to 280 to compensate appropriately.
The most common critical illness we see in peds is septic shock.
If they have it, it's going to increase their mortality by 33%.
Hypotension is not a requirement for pediatric septic shock. Pediatric patients' ability to compensate with those parameters becomes an integral part of the assessment of sepsis.
Welcome to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, and I could not be more excited about the podcast that we are about to do. We are getting rid of or not talking about our adult patients this podcast, which is 99% of the patient population that we've talked about here since the podcast started. We are going to get back to some pediatric critical care medicine, specifically pediatric and neonatal septic shock. And joining me are two superstars in pediatric emergency medicine. The first is a new voice here to the podcast, and that is Dr. Barry Bostic. Barry just completed our combined EM pediatric residency here at University of Maryland Emergency Medicine, and she is an amazing clinician. Once again, a pediatric emergency medicine superstar destined to do great things in the field. So Barry, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
And joining Barry and myself is a voice you've heard before for probably our last pediatric critical care discussion here on the podcast, and that's Dr. Mimi Liu. Many of you, as you know, Mimi Liu finished our emergency medicine residency here at UMEM, then did a PEDS EM fellowship out west in California, and then has since come back and revamped and done an amazing job with our pediatric EM curriculum here at UMEM. Mimi, thanks so much for joining us once again here on CCPEM.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm thrilled to be here.
Once again, as I said, it's great to talk about some pediatric emergency medicine and critical care, and probably the most common critical illness we see in peds, similar to adults, is septic shock. And when I came across these updated guidelines or practice parameters that were literally just published in Critical Care Medicine, I thought immediately of the two of you to get you on the podcast and talk about it. And that document, for those of you who are interested, we will certainly list that in our handout for this podcast. But the American College of Critical Care Medicine, Clinical Practice Parameters for Hemodynamic Support of Pediatric and Neonatal Septic Shock. And we're going to get Barry and Mimi's opinions on this document and really what are the key changes that we need to know when that sick child comes in with septic shock. So to get us started, Barry, I'm actually going to turn to you before we do a deeper dive into the specific recommendations. Kind of what's the executive summary? What are the big changes in this document?
Well, first of all, they wanted to go over the guidelines from 2002 and 2007 to see if there had been any changes in morbidity, mortality, how were the recommendations working, was there anything that needed to change. Really, when they looked at it, they figured out that most of it was working pretty well. There are very few new recommendations, but they did have a very strong continued emphasis on resuscitation in the first hour, recognizing the child that is septic, that is in need of help, and trying to get those interventions enacted within the first hour. So that's kind of the biggest thing. And it moved a lot from the provider recognizing and getting all this stuff enacted to bundles where they can recognize it and triage and help start a cascade in order to get the child's interventions more quickly.
And in terms of that recognition, is it similar to adults in terms of focusing on abnormal vital signs? What's perhaps different with the pediatric or neonatal patient?
Actually, it very much is similar to adults. You know, now that we're getting those parameters that will pop up on our computer and tell us that this person might qualify for sepsis, it's very similar. And they've been able to, especially the bigger pediatric hospitals, have been able to enact recognition pathways to be able to bring the child back quicker. And they are going to be based on the parameters for each age group, which is different than adults. It's not just a set cutoff. It will be based on how old the child is, but they'll use heart rate a lot. They use blood pressure, cap refill, and also mental status. Those are the big ones that they use when they're figuring out who needs to be brought back first.
And in terms of once we have that early recognition, similar terms of treatment protocols where we're focusing on early antibiotics and early fluid resuscitation, is that correct?
That's exactly right. So getting their IV within the first 1 to 5 minutes, getting them fluids, reassessing to see if they need more fluids or if they need to move towards ionotropes or vasoactives, and giving them antibiotics within the first 60 minutes. That's what they're really working on.
Okay, so we'll do a little bit deeper dive shortly into the vasoactive agents. But before we get a little bit further down the road, Mimi, let me turn to you and just for the highlights of pediatric physiology, as I think all of our listeners are aware, there may be slight differences between the pediatric patient with septic shock versus the adult patient with sepsis or septic shock.
Regarding some of the physiologic differences between peds, I would say probably some of the biggest parameters are cardiac output, as we know, is a measure of heart rate versus stroke volume, and the pediatric patient's ability to compensate with those parameters becomes an integral part of the assessment of sepsis. For an adult who becomes septic, they can easily increase their heart rate from 70 to 140. It's really hard for a young infant to go from 140 to 280 to compensate appropriately. And the younger they are, the relatively underdeveloped some of their cardiovascular parameters are in order to support that heart rate and stroke volume. So inevitably, a lot of pediatric sepsis comes down to this concept of cold shock versus warm shock. And unlike our adults, where we often get this kind of high cardiac output, low vascular resistance state, kids tend to have a low cardiac output state and high systemic vascular resistance, such as that kind of clamped down cold shock. Adults often will have more of that warm shock physiologic state with the high cardiac output and the low systemic vascular resistance. So this affects some of the vasoactive agents that we'll choose later on. And I believe we're going to be talking about that a little later. And unlike adults, where we sometimes rely on hypotension as one of our vital signs to help us delve into whether or not a patient's actually in septic shock, hypotension is not a requirement for pediatric septic shock. To reiterate what Barry said, a lot of times septic shock is diagnosed by the clinical signs, hypo or hypothermia, altered mental status, and either that peripheral vasodilation or vasoconstriction with cap refill kind of integrated into that assessment.
Well, very good. That's a great review of some quick pearls in terms of vital sign abnormalities, what we're looking for specifically, or what we need to think about in terms of neonate with septic shock. Let's actually delve into getting to the bedside and actually resuscitating these sick kids with septic shock. Barry, let me turn back to you. Those clinical signs, let's kind of go over those once again. What are the key things we should pay attention to, or the key abnormalities we should pay attention to?
I think we can't go over this enough. So it's going to be the heart rate is going to be really big in children and neonates. And as some easy parameters that they set off as infants, if the heart rate is less than 90 or greater than 160, that's something we need to pay attention to. In children, heart rate less than 70 or greater than 150. You can also break that down a little bit more detailed by age, but those are kind of some general parameters for kids. If it's outside of those parameters, that's going to be something that we really need to pay attention to. Do you want to look at hypotension? If they have it, it's going to increase their mortality by 33%. So it's something you need to look at. And lastly is cap refill. We pay attention to cap refill a lot in children. And if it's greater than 3 seconds, you really want to focus on that child quickly. Cold shock does happen in kids and it can be easily misdiagnosed in children. There are a lot of people... I'm sorry, he's distracting me.
So before we go any further, just for our listeners, that is not sound effects that we are playing in the background. Dr. Bostic actually delivered her first child a little less than 2 weeks ago. So her and her husband, David, welcomed Holden into the world. So she is so dedicated to pediatric resuscitation and emergency medicine that he is beside her while we're recording this podcast. So Barry, a big congratulations, and then we can cut back to the podcast.
Yes, sorry. So even though we are using cap refill, sometimes you can think that cold shock can be easily misdiagnosed in children. Providers who thought that children were in cold shock or had a high SVR actually ended up having a low SVR when they got to invasive cardiac monitoring. So that's something to think about. So the trigger tools we're using are vital signs, physical exam, and at-risk populations. And for physical exam, it's going to be a lot about the mental status. The lethargic child, I know we shy away from using that term because it can be so bad, but if the child is lethargic, it's really a sign that they are in trouble. And at-risk populations, so children who already have genetic abnormalities or already have cancer are more likely to have sepsis. So you want to think about them first and bring them back first.
I think you said some key numbers just before we go on to the IV access. So heart rate less than 90 or heart rate greater than 160.
For infants,
yep. And then for children, heart rate less than 70, heart rate greater than 150. We're not going to see hypotension as often as, say, in adults, but we're paying attention to capillary refill along with mental status changes. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
Okay, so then we consider those vital sign abnormalities, the exam, and then those at-risk populations. What do we do next?
So once we have these trigger tools that should be triggered in triage, that child should be brought back as soon as possible, and we want IV access within 5 minutes. If we can't do that, IO needs to be considered heavily. We want to start our fluid resuscitation right away, and ideally, we want to have the first 20 mLs per kg done within the first 30 minutes. Most likely, kids will need more than that. We talked about they're going to have a low cardiac output. Most children with sepsis are going to have hypovolemia, so they'll most likely need more fluids than that, but having that first 20 mLs per kg in within the first 30 minutes is our goal. You want to reassess for fluid overload before you give anything more, but you can continue to give all the way up to 40 to 60 mLs per kg if they need it. There have been a couple of studies in the past couple of years, especially that this review looked at, whether it was crystalloid or colloid, it doesn't really matter. If their hemoglobin is less than 10, they might benefit from some blood, but otherwise colloids seem to be good in terms of the albumin, or crystalloids seem to work just fine. They also looked at a study that looked at doing boluses versus just going straight to maintenance fluid. Didn't really seem to make a difference either way as well. You just want to get that fluid into them and continue to reassess to make sure that they're not getting fluid overloaded.
So those are outstanding clinical pearls. Let me ask a few specific questions regarding that. And Mimi, feel free to chime in here. So IV or IO access, give them fluids, 20 mLs per kilo, likely to need more on the end of 40 to 60 mLs per kilo. In terms of antibiotics, since you both practice in the peds ED along with the adult ED, recognizing that antibiotic selection, yes, is based upon where we practice, our population, the antibiograms specifically, but are there remarkable differences between the antibiotics empirically that you would select for the pediatric population compared to the adult?
In adults, a lot of times we like to dose them with the vitamin Z and vitamin V, I would say, vancomycin and essentially broad spectrum antibiotics. Oftentimes at university, we'll choose vancomycin and zosyn, depending on relative resistance. But in peds, actually, we still maintain the same concept of broad spectrum antibiotics, oftentimes vancomycin and ceftriaxone. Zosyn isn't used as often. There isn't as much of the pseudomonas coverage that you'll need to cover. In neonates, on contrast, ampicillin plus cefotaxime plus or minus vancomycin plus or minus acyclovir are oftentimes the go-to broad spectrum antibiotics.
That's helpful. And in terms of fluid resuscitation, Mimi, Barry went over the numbers per se, but in adults, especially with the latest Surviving Sepsis campaign guidelines, talking about using dynamic markers beyond that initial fluid bolus, are those also recommended in the pediatric population in terms of sepsis resuscitation?
A lot of the modalities we are using in adults, passive leg raise and these other kind of non-invasive markers, have not quite trickled down through the pediatric literature. The guidelines are actually suggesting a lot more of the SCVO2 monitoring that we've shied away from in the management of adults with sepsis. So the dynamic parameters are, again, just frequent reassessments, assessing heart rate, cap refill, focusing on the clinical exam instead of the lab parameters that we'll tend to do more in the adult population.
Okay, great. So early recognition, starting off my bundles, getting access, giving fluids, antibiotics, assuming that we need, obviously, cultures as well, and then continuing fluid resuscitation based upon clinical response. Mimi, let's just say the patients or the child is getting sicker and we may need to intervene or intubation. Any pearls with respect to intubation in the pediatric or neonatal septic patient?
Regarding RSI, unlike adults, the peds continues to shy away from using etomidate due to the concerns for adrenal insufficiency unless there's some other clinical parameter indication, for example, chronic steroid use. We do like ketamine. We're tending to use that more in the adults as well, but peds definitely likes ketamine for early induction and consideration of atropine, but not necessarily routinely. The most recent PALS guidelines has actually shied away from routine use of atropine for RSI, but I would argue that there's still a role for atropine, and people have almost, I think, gone to the extreme and said no atropine in kids. But I think there is a select patient population that still may benefit. Essentially, any patient that even a brief moment of bradycardia may cause them just to tip over that edge and fall into a downward spiral. Those are actually the patients I would reserve for atropine. It tends to be the younger patients, often less than 1 year of age. I've moved away from routine use, but there are still some patients I think may benefit from consideration of atropine during RSI. So consideration of atropine, use of ketamine, avoiding etomidate, and a long-acting paralytic like rocuronium would be, I think, great combination for RSI agents.
Outstanding pearls. Now, quick question or follow-up to that. More often in the adult patient, septic shock, they're hypotensive heading in. Many are pulling up what's been referred to as push-dose pressors. Others are starting a vasopressor infusion. Is that similar in the pediatric patient heading into RSI? Are you using epinephrine infusions, norepinephrine infusions, or perhaps even the push-dose pressor concept?
I think the adult literature is somewhat sparse when it comes to push-dose pressors for intubation or starting that epinephrine infusion early on. The literature within the pediatric critical care is even more sparse. I think it's reasonable, though, and these guidelines do suggest that starting an epinephrine infusion for those patients that are really on the brink and on the cusp of just acute decompensation may be beneficial as well. So if you're reaching for those pressors early on, it makes sense if they're on the fence to go ahead and start that infusion early.
All right, outstanding. Well, Barry, I'm coming back to you, and let's continue. Let's get back onto the septic shock patient. We talked a little bit about the peri-intubation, but once again, fluids, early recognition, antibiotics, fluids. Let's say that the patient's hemodynamic status has not significantly improved, or their exam or clinical numbers haven't improved with fluids alone, and now we're thinking about vasoactive agents. And certainly, although I don't see anyone less than 19 years of age, I do know and remember from training that sometimes there are differences in the selection of vasoactive agents with the pediatric population. Walk us through what these guidelines or recommendations say, and in your own clinical experience, what pressures you're using in these patients.
So I think before it was always kids, always dopamine first. And I think while we are still using dopamine a lot, and it is still very prevalent, we are kind of moving towards starting with an epinephrine or a norepinephrine as well. This guidelines in general also really tried to emphasize that you should pick your pressor based on what clinical situation you're seeing. So if you see a cold shock, you should actually start with an epinephrine or a dopamine, and a low dose dopamine can actually help you with ionotropic support as well. If you have a wide pulse pressure, you might want to start with a norepinephrine and maybe start that first before starting the dopamine. So really to try to focus on which pressors that you're starting first, which was helpful. I think in our population, we do tend to lean towards epinephrine or norepinephrine first, and then dopamine as well as an adjunct. And if you really need the ionotropic support, a dopamine or a low-dose epinephrine.
All right, great. And it probably seems like a silly question, but are we still targeting the same MAP for pediatric and neonatal patients?
It's interesting. You can use MAP. This guideline really wanted you to look on perfusion pressure. So that's going to require some invasive monitoring, but it was looking at MAP minus CVP or MAP minus intra-abdominal pressure and using that perfusion pressure as a goal. It also talked again a lot about SCVO2 greater than 70% and cardiac index as a way to figure out where you're going and how to best resuscitate the child.
Okay, great. Well, Mimi, I'm coming back to you, and let's kind of come towards the home stretch here in our discussion. And Barry just mentioned SCVO2. You mentioned it a little bit earlier. Give us thoughts on continued monitoring in the pediatric patient. Lactate, SCVO2, should we be using both? Help us out there for continued monitoring.
In our adults with sepsis, we're actually using lactate a lot more as a lab parameter to help not only define, but to follow their resolution. And in peds, the data on lactate is a little bit more variable. A normal lactate doesn't rule out sepsis, but a high lactate does portend higher morbidity and mortality. So I would use lactate in the sense of if it's really high, it may kind of trigger you to think a little bit harder, but I wouldn't use it to rule anything out and reassure yourself. Lactate is used a lot more in the PICU for trending than it is how we use it in the adults for recognition. Regarding PICU monitoring for central monitoring, they do like keeping the SCVO2 over 70 as a goal, and the cardiac index a little bit higher than usual, anywhere between 3.3 and 6. But a lot of this is it more invasive monitoring. Now, as you know, Mike, I practice out in a community peds ED, and hopefully by now we've kind of made arrangements for transfer to a PICU. We're not placing these SCVO2 monitors where I am. We're hoping to have them shipped out where they can get appropriately monitored.
Great, great points. And I think before we close here, any final thoughts, Barry and then Mimi, in terms of when our providers, whether it be in the ED, in the ICU, are managing these pediatric or neonatal septic shock patients, what are your key take-home points?
So I think for me, a lot of the bigger children's centers have moved towards a trigger bundle or trigger points in order to recognize these children very quickly. And it seems to have helped a lot. And I think even in the community EDs, having some of those trigger points with specific age vital signs would be important towards getting them back and getting the resuscitation started quickly. I think that's one of the bigger points and bigger recommendations that they made from these guidelines, was to make it an institutional trigger rather than the provider 30 minutes into the visit recognizing that the sepsis was there.
Great. And Mimi?
I would say remembering that children with septic shock have often proportionately larger fluid quantity requirements compared to adults. First hour fluid resuscitation, early antibiotics, early vasopressor, that's a lot of the same concepts that we carry from the adult literature. Steroids is a little controversial, and in kids, early ECMO use is a lot of promising results. Kids are doing, especially the neonates, are doing quite well on early ECMO. So consideration of early transfer for ECMO therapy in your really sick patient is something to consider as well. I mentioned earlier that hypotension is a late sign and certainly isn't a requirement for septic shock, but remembering that the PELS definition of hypotension, 2 times the age plus 70, is often the 5th percentile, and that's way low. I actually encourage people to remember 2 times the age plus 90 instead. That's the 50th percentile or the median. I'd much rather know where they're supposed to be than when I'm way late and way behind at that 5th percentile. So that's one of the things that you can help use when you're using that clinical assessment to see how the patient's doing. Probably the biggest point that I'd like to highlight is oftentimes I will encourage people to remember that when it comes to resuscitation, the core principles that you learn with adult resuscitation really can be applied the vast majority of pediatric septic shock as well. The things that you know and are comfortable with in adult sepsis. We talked about a lot of the minor differences, but if you treat these patients the same concepts, early fluid resuscitation, early recognition, early antibiotics, and frequent reassessments, you're gonna do these patients a great service. So just remember the core principles you learned with adult resuscitation and be ready to apply a lot of those core principles to the pediatric patient and you'll do fine.
Well, those were outstanding pearls, and I can't thank both of you enough for joining us to talk about a really stressful situation, certainly the very sick pediatric patient coming in, and then specifically those with septic shock. You've given us a lot of pearls, brought us up to date in terms of 2017 and this latest American College of Critical Care Medicine practice parameter. So much appreciated. Barry, once again, a huge congratulations on the birth of your little boy. I know that things are going well, but we really appreciate you taking the time out, really so close after delivery, to educate and give all of our listeners pearls. And Mimi, I know you're in the midst of moving. So our thanks amidst taking a break from packing up boxes to also once again make valuable contributions and give us a lot of pearls and potential pitfalls for these patients. So thanks to the two of you again.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
And for any of you who have questions for Mimi or Barry, please shoot us an email through the website. I'll quickly get those over to both of them and get you a reply. And with that, we're going to bring this podcast to a close and we will talk to you next month.